December 31st, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S. And this week, I had a really good discussion with Scotty and Phil last week on OpenHP SDR. And it got me digging out some of my development boards and spending some time on CUDA programming. So did a little bit of catching up on that kind of stuff. That's it for me. Next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording. And go ahead, Mike.
Well, thanks, Dave. Greeting to everyone on the TeamSpeak session, and hope you all have a safe and happy New Year.
Fine business, Mike. And next on the list, we have Nathan in 2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, Dave. How are you? Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy holidays, everyone. I have been, celebrating the holiday season this week and continuing to work on some of my schoolwork and things like that. So back to the net, W2NAF.
Fine business. And next on the list is Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody in the group. It's been a real quiet week. Had a wonderful holiday and still enjoying the rest of the week.
And then next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, hello. Thanks, Dave. Good afternoon, evening, morning to everyone. A little light this week, I guess, because of the holidays, but having a reasonable holiday here, except my wife is not having a reasonable holiday. She's in the hospital with a kidney infection, so she's not having fun at all. So we have to make up for it here by having more fun to average it out. Anyway, I've been working more on the schematic, and I have a couple questions for Tom on the power requirements for the RF board. And I think that's about it on this end. And Dave, the board you sent me a picture of wasn't the one I was thinking of. The one I was thinking of was the Max 10 board that you had just bought, a month or two ago. Anyway, back over to you there.
Yes, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill. I don't know if Bill's there, but he can join in. Go ahead.
Let me see. Maybe I'm not. Are you hearing me now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, very good. All right. Well, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all. I haven't been working on the project for the last week because of the holiday and everybody's doing the same thing. But I did have a couple of questions to Scotty because I've been thinking about it while having a chance to drive 12 hours in each direction from Orlando to here to visiting the grandchildren in Orlando. dealing with the question of the small board computer talking to the data engine. Now, all right, I got the concept of discovering the data engine, and I can make all that work. Then the next question is, I'd like to be able to, I think I need to be able to send the data engine some commands to tell it what data to send. Like, for example, I feel like I need to be able to send the data engine some channel configuration data. Say, okay, I'm going to send you a list of several channels I want to have running. And for example, say I want to run 5 channels. And here is the center frequency of each one, and say maybe the bandwidth. I'm not sure what all I can send, and then after that, when I tell the system go, it'll start. Well, it'll get the time. It'll incorporate it into a data package, and then starting sending me those channels. So do I have it? Am I understanding it correctly? This is the right way to do it. That I should. From the small board computer side, give a list of channels from which I wish to that I would like to receive data regarding those. Do I understand it right? Is this the right way to do it? Go ahead, Scotty.
I think we're done with the list, right, Dave?
Yes, go ahead.
Bill, I think you have it exactly right. the way I had envisioned it, and I apologize for not getting the spec out, but I'm behind on everything as usual. But and I'm figuring the hardware is a little more important, because while they're working on the hardware, I can be continuing on the spec. At any rate, the idea was that when you establish the discovery, when you do the discovery, you end up with a channel that's that I call the configuration. I believe I got this right, the configuration channel. So basically, each piece of hardware out there, each data engine that's on the network, is going to have its own discovery its own control channel, its own configuration channel to the back to the single board computer. Now that configuration channel is going to be used to set up pairs of channels, which are going to be a control channel and a data stream. So the idea is that you set up a control channel, and that channel sets up a data stream, which define and that control channel will define to the hardware what data rate, what width, which ADC is going to use, all the different parameters of that particular stream. And so that control channel then will be used to turn the stream on and off, reconfigure it, do whatever you need to do with that stream. And then you'll have, if you want to get another stream from the same radio, you'll open up another control channel with the config channel, and that control channel will be used to open up another stream. And the stream can be either direction. So if you want to send audio to the transmitter, or you want to get receive audio from the receiver, either way, it'll be configurable by this control channel. Does that jive with what you're thinking?
Yeah, that's a little bit more elaborate than what I have in mind, but we can absolutely implement that. So now you mentioned which ADC. How many ADCs are going to be running in this? I was thinking it was two. Is that right?
Well, on our initial version, there's two, but it will depend upon what you have plugged onto the data engine. So as part of the configuration channel, you will be able to query the hardware to find out what kind of resources are available. And then the idea is all of the control commands will be ACT at the UDP, like a layer on top of UDP, but the streams will not be. So that the stream can be set up, and the setting up of the stream, like if you say, I want to talk to ADC number 3 and there's only two ADCs, then you get a NAC back and nothing happens, but you do get a NAC back to say, sorry, I can't do that.
All right, so the control channels, when you say channel, are you talking about it'll be talking on a different port, or a channel by some data at the front that tells it what it is you're talking to? What defines a channel?
Channel is defined by the receiver that the recipient is listening on.
By that, do you mean the port?
You said that. I didn't get all that. It chopped out.
Scotty, quick question. Is this the same as the version 2 protocol, or is this something different?
This is something different, because the version 2 protocol has pre-assigned channels that you can then override. But in our case, every channel is going to have to be requested, because I don't think it's reasonable to assume that the guy on the other end, that you know what channels he's going to be able to listen on. So you're going to use the configuration channel to request a port to send data to.
Okay, so there's no pre-existing document that Bill might be able to look at?
No, there really isn't. And I've got mine partially done, but perhaps Bill, I could send you the first chapter, which kind of defines a scenario of how it works without defining all the commands and all the bit definitions, but at least it gives you an idea of what I'm thinking of in my mind. So if I'm way off base, we can fix it early.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to have that. talk about request a port, and then I suppose you mean a port, when you define a socket, you tell it what port it's supposed to talk and listen on. So I assume we're talking about an IP port. I have pretty good command over how those work. I just have to study on this to make sure that I don't develop a whole lot of stuff that has to be thrown out later. But I tell you what, I will say this, that even reproducing the way the discovery and data channels work, even with this on the simple case, has been a huge and wonderful learning experience. So I'm coming up to speed and all of that, but keeping track of a whole bunch of different channels and different ports running at the same kind of concurrently. Again, it can be done with threads and everything else, but I just have to make sure I have a handle on what the expectation is. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We're going to have like tables at each end defining what ports are what. And after looking at it, my understanding mostly is that if you're using ports like we're using them, if you can define a port that that the data engine is listening on, then that really defines a channel, because he really doesn't care what port on the SPC it comes from. Although in general, you're going to open a socket, so you're going to use the same port over and over again. But I don't really think it matters what port it comes from. But of course, it matters what port you're listening on, because if you're listening on the wrong port, you're never going to see anything.
Well, that's part of the interesting thing about the way discovery works, is when you go out to do a discovery, one of the things that you're going to do, there's going to be a sort of a reply, and from that you can extract the IP and port address of the data engine when it answers. So there are some things that happen kind of in the infrastructure from which you can extract some of that information. At least that's what I've been seeing so far. You just have to make sure that you take a look at what comes back after you do a discovery, and a lot of the stuff that you're looking for tends to be in there. Go ahead.
Right. I'm just thinking that I'm not clear as to whether the from port really has to be enforced or not, because I don't think it really matters. If you wanted to send to the same listening port on the DE from a different port on the SBC, I don't really think the data engine cares that it's a different port, unless we make a rule that it has to be. And because the idea is I wanted to be able to have the single SBC be able to talk to multiple data engines, so it could use different IP addresses to the same port, for instance. Or I want to have multiple data engines, or one data engine talk to multiple SBCs. So again, they would use the data engine is going to have to keep track of what IP address and what the port is listening on, but the data engine can have different listening ports to listen to different SBCs. That makes sense. So they would come from different IP addresses. The from port won't matter, but the to port, the data engine can listen on multiple incoming ports from different IP addresses.
Right. But now, are you anticipating that a single DE is going to respond to multiple IP addresses? That doesn't jibe with me. I can see where you, if you're going to have multiple data engines within talking to a single SBC, they would be on different IPs. But I think once a data engine is assigned an IP, it should stick with that, because otherwise there's a kind of potential for a lot of confusion.
Yes, you're correct. Maybe I didn't state it right. Is that each bit of hardware, whether it's a DE or a single board computer, has one IP address, and it differentiates its incoming data, incoming channels, if you will, incoming sources by port numbers. However, if you have two SBCs and one data engine on the same network, three IP addresses, the data engine can send traffic to two different IP addresses, which would be two different pieces of hardware.
Well, now, when we first started talking about this, we talked about a data engine that would be paired with a single SBC. That makes up a tangerine. Now we're talking about something that's quite a bit more sophisticated than that. Do you really anticipate we're going to do that in phase one of this project?
No, I just want to not rule it out. So I want to make the protocol such that we don't break the possibility of doing that, like Protocol 2 did on OpenHPSDR.
Okay, I'm with you. All right, so we can do that. I just want to be careful we don't wind up producing a product that's something like produced by IBM, where it's so general purpose, is incredibly difficult to ever make it work in the real world. We have to be a little bit careful of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the creeping elegance problem. I'm with you on that. I just want to make sure that, because really, to my mind, the things I want to do from my point of view, which is not personal space weather station, this is separate from that, so it really is not, doesn't really have to be implemented on phase one of personal space weather station, because this is a superset to me. But but I want to be able to have a single DE and multiple, pardon me, a single SBC and multiple DEs, or more likely, I'm going to have a single DE and multiple SBCs, because I'm going to want to stream one or two windows to each PC, but they're going to be all single board, all low performance computers like Raspberry Pis. So you don't want to overload them. So you want to send, 48K or 96K to each of two or three or four computers, all off of one data engine, because we're grabbing all the data. So, let's shuffle out some streams instead of like the Personal Space Weather Station, where all eight go to the same single board computer. We might want to split it amongst several. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Now, the one thing, now let's see, are we going to be able to implement this very sophisticated security scheme that we talked about last couple of weeks when we're talking about really small stuff like Raspberry Pis and stuff? Are we anticipating that we're going to be able to achieve that with the ultra? I mean, you can do an awful lot with an Odroid N2. I mean, it's almost as powerful as my desktop. But when you're talking about Raspberry, we got to be careful we don't have requirements on this thing that conflict with each other.
Right. And see, I was putting all of the the remote command and control, the RCC, with the main computer, the cloud, I was putting that all on the SBC. So Raspberry Pi might not be the best choice in that case. But on the other hand, you could build the network out of a very low-end single board computer and the data engine, and then put a really robust firewall between that and the outside world and get your security that way.
Yeah, I copy that. Although that doesn't sound like the conversation we're talking about with your buddy from Motorola.
Well, that's what I presented to him, and he claims that you're going to have trouble even with that architecture. So I still have to get with him and see what his views are on how we could best do this then, because do you really think it's reasonable to take a Raspberry Pi and connect it to the internet directly without any firewall or anything?
There's Raspberry Pi supports UFW, so it has a built-in firewall capability.
You think it's robust enough though to just connect directly to the internet and withstand any of the attacks that you might get?
I would think it's the same as any Linux system.
Don't some people build firewalls based on Raspberry Pis?
Yeah, I think they do.
So yeah, it's really not a matter of having to have a piece of physical hardware between the Raspberry Pi and the rest of the internet. It's a matter of making sure that these things are configured correctly, I would think.
Yeah, the concern I have is, there's only one Ethernet interface on the Pi, and to use a firewall correctly, you typically need separate WAN and LAN interfaces.
Yes, that is true. I start thinking about, okay, well, we're going to have the, let's say if we have a Raspberry Pi talking to the data engine, you're going to have another Raspberry Pi to act as a firewall. Again, we got to be careful about making this thing overly sophisticated, especially in phase one, because, the typical home users, there's going to be a router, whatever's provided by AT&T or somebody like that. That's going to fend off most of the garbage that comes off the public raw internet. We got to be careful about trying to do too much. Go ahead.
Well, you're gonna have a router. You're gonna have probably a NAT interface, a NAT firewall between this unit, the Personal Space Weather Station, and the outside world. So then you're going to have to configure that to allow the tunneling through of the data that you want to send up to the server, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, when it comes to talking to the central control system, since that's a full-blown server, there are some things we can do. I mean, I suppose we could set up a virtual private network or something. But, I mean, if we really think that that's necessary.
Yeah, and I don't know that it is. When I mentioned that we're going to have the three-port bridge on the data engine, and we're going to plug the Raspberry Pi into one port and the outside network into another port, and the third port's going to go to the FPGA. My buddy from Motorola there is kind of saying, well, that's not really a robust bridge. It's not going to have all the security features that you need, so you're going to have trouble isolating the traffic that goes from the network to the SBC versus the traffic that goes between the data engine on the SBC. It's a limitation of the firewall of the bridge chip we're using because, you know, it's only a $5 chip. It's not a full-blown mega router.
Yeah.
I tried to summarize that. I think it was 2 weeks ago in the minutes for the call. There's a paragraph or two where I tried to wrap up a summary and a couple of options.
You're going to have to think about this one a little bit. I know it's doable. It's just it's going to have to study this one because it has the opportunity to turn into a project that, you know, one of those projects where no matter what you want to do, you have to do something else first. It can turn into one of those things where it becomes a snowball of complexity when that's kind of, I don't know, orthogonal to what we're really trying to achieve as far as the science objectives of the project. But now, I mean, I get what everybody's talking about. It may be one of these things we have to just leave some stubs in there that we plug security stuff into later.
Yeah, Tom, I found the thing that you wrote 2 weeks ago, and that said it was not clear that everyone is talking about the same interfaces. The SBC has two logical interfaces, one to the data engine and one to the internet, but one physical Ethernet interface. With the current DE design having two Ethernet connectors, the internet traffic travels through the data engine to the SBC. So can the local command and control protocol adequately isolate the data engine to SBC traffic from the internet traffic from a security perspective? That was the question. Do we need a router with a firewall to isolate the data engine from the internet? Would that be adequate? Is it likely that would be available anyway, such as embedded within a home DSL cable modem or the university equivalent?
Yeah, it seems to me that given the fact that the SBC and the data engine need to talk to each other and that traffic is going to be exposed to something else on the network, it seems to me that a router like the DSL router that was just mentioned is a minimum requirement. If you really want to have good security.
It also occurred to me that, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was going to mention that some of the single board computers have multiple Ethernet interfaces, and some have, you know, one Wi-Fi plus one physical interface. And those are, you know, and given the fact that if you're running Linux or a Linux port on the SBC, you have a fair amount of security capability there.
Yeah, and I thought about putting two separate Ethernet ports on the data engine and letting the FPGA manage it, but then you're back to the same problem is you have whatever you put in the FPGA has got to be robust enough to maintain isolation between the two ports. And I don't think that it would do it any better than the hardware three-port chip that we have.
Yeah, so the question, you know, a three-port chip is really cool, but the question is it causing us problems? Really, we want the three-port functionality on the single board computer because then it can enforce VLANs, it could enforce routing rules, it could enforce firewalls. That's all built into Linux. And so the question is, you know, can we achieve that by having one Wi-Fi port and one hardwired port? I'm questioning whether the three-port chip on the data engine is going to be a detriment rather than an advantage.
Well, that leads me to another question is I'm looking at the Wi-Fi implementation because we were going to put Wi-Fi on the board and it's relatively inexpensive, but the problem is the inexpensive chips are really designed for IoT devices. So they're designed to like collect sensor data and do things like that. They're not really designed to stream data because they're typically, you know, a serial port at 9600 baud is the interface to it.
Yes.
And I'm having difficulty finding an inexpensive Wi-Fi chip that does a lot of high bandwidth data. So the bottom line is that the Wi-Fi is going to be good for maybe some kind of control or security interface, but it's not going to really be any good for streaming any data.
Yeah, so, you know, the possibility, of course, is that the Wi-Fi on the single board computer connects to the internet through your home Wi-Fi system, and then the gigabit Ethernet on the single board computer talks to the gig-E on the data engine, and then the single board computer enforces whatever rules you want. My Wi-Fi at home streams YouTube at 4K.
So you could plug in a USB 3 gigabit Ethernet adapter too.
Yeah, those are all possibilities. I don't, you know what's cost effective and what's available from an SBC. All I'm suggesting is that Linux has a tremendous security toolkit built into it already. You don't have to write it, you just have to configure the rules. And so that brings up the question, does a three-port switch chip on the data engine help us or does it hurt us?
Well, the thing is that it's almost comes in for free. The major expense of the three-port interface is the second RJ45. And it's about $5. And then the PHY chip is about $5. And the triple port chip is about $8.
Okay, so...
So we're talking about an $8 bonus here for having the three-port. And, you know, you could always just use a single port of it. And my problem is that I don't really think there's going to be enough FPGA resources to do... 2 gigabit max, and plus put all the security interface in between. Especially like you pointed out, Linux has all this built in. So, would we be better off requiring an external router, and with you know a port to the DE and a port to the SBC and a port to the user's network?
I think you may not be understanding what I'm trying to say. The SBC can simultaneously be the host. A controller for the data engine and also the gateway to the internet. Use the Wi-Fi on the SBC as the gateway to the internet. Use the gigabit Ethernet on the SBC to connect to the data engine.
Okay, and then just effectively the router software runs on Linux and the SBC under Linux.
That's certainly one possibility.
That's how I originally envisioned it. I originally envisioned like the SBC as being the gateway between the internet and the data engine. And the SBC would have, you know, more than one Ethernet interface, and the data engine would really only talk to the SBC.
Well, and I think that works for control. It's just that I wanted the data engine to be able to directly stream out to the internet. With UDP packets. And of course, my buddy from Motorola, as soon as I say directly stream to the internet from the data engine, he freaks out.
You know, because that kind of what that means, you're going to be exposing the data engine to the raw internet. I mean, I suppose it would be a switch in between, but a switch doesn't have the kind of logical knowledge to know that there's a 10,000 Russian and Chinese guys trying to talk to it.
Yeah, there are other issues as well. In some countries, you may be forced to use IPv6 to go to the internet. And so you'd like a device capable of exposing IPv6 to the WAN and IPv4 to the LAN.
So that would be the data engine, if it was going to talk directly to the internet, would have to understand IPv6, you mean?
And it might have to understand both 6 and 4.
Hey, you know, I just want to program radio. I don't want to program IP stacks.
Well, and that's why using something that's already been done, for example, Linux, may be a far simpler solution.
Yeah, so the multiple ports might be a good solution. Also, keep in mind, we have a high-speed USB 3 connection, too, that we could use. So we could actually use that between the data engine and the single board computer, and then use the Ethernet on the single board computer as the single network connection.
Yeah, that's a possibility as well. You know, there's a 3 or 4 options, many of which are commercially available, so it wouldn't require any development resources.
Hasn't there been a lot of concern? I know Phil Erickson has talked about this, about issues using USB for transporting radio data.
I'm not sure that, he's talked about it, I think, but I don't think there's any insurmountable issues. And this would be a point-to-point between the data engine and the SBC. So it would be a very secure protocol because it'd be nothing else plugged onto it and nothing else could get in the way of the data stream.
Yeah, I would have concerns about latency because the USB is at its core a polling protocol. And as you add hubs and things, you change the latency in the polling loops.
I think that's where Phil was really concerned. He said that every time there's been a USB solution, there's always been issues with latency or timing issues that just don't come up with the Ethernet protocol.
Yeah,
so yeah, and I could think that's true.
Yeah, so it may be that, you know, the three-port chip on the data engine is very cool and is very cost-effective. And in phase one of the project, we may just not elect to use that functionality. We might elect to use only one of those ports. I think our collection of single board computers may provide us some adequate solutions.
Yeah, and if we really need it to be split like that, there are, like you said, there are single board computers that have 2 gigabit ports.
I would go with that solution.
I have ones that have 5, I think.
Yeah, see, so that's the beauty of it, is that by using Ethernet allowing us to pick whatever board we want that's correct, that has the features we need, we can solve this problem by correct, judicious selection of hardware.
Yeah, I would follow the advice of your security friend, and that when it comes to security, you really should not roll your own. You should use well-vetted security solutions.
Yeah, and I'm really fine. Oh, go ahead, Nathan.
Yeah, and the other advantage to using well-vetted security solutions is there's other people, those people who vet that, they're watching it, and so they're going to roll out patches when there are issues.
Yeah, and if we leave the 3-port gigabit Ethernet in there, because it really doesn't cost anything or very little, and it's useful in the case where you're building a local network, and maybe not so useful in the PSWS case where we might use a dual gigabit ported board.
That seems reasonable to me.
Can I break in here a minute? We have another person that didn't check in yet. Dave Witten. KD0EAG has joined us, and I just want to acknowledge that.
I'm sorry I'm late again. I had a birthday party I had to go to. Didn't have any real way to opt out of it, but mostly I'm just listening anyway. So, thank you.
Hopefully you got some good presents.
Wasn't my birthday. I don't need any more of those right away.
Yeah, really. The presents you can use, but not so much for the birthdays. Anyway, by the way, thanks for those links that you sent me.
I hope they clarified some of that discussion on the HPSDR, OpenHPSDR TeamSpeak.
Yeah, so just to kind of summarize, this is what I learned from all that gobbledygook, was that NVIDIA is coming out with 2 lines of boards, and since they're too cheap to afford 2 names for boards, they're reusing the same names. So they're calling the 200-pin edge card connector boards Jetson boards. They have a Jetson prefix. So now they have a Jetson Xavier and they have a Jetson NX Xavier, and they're both 240-pin interfaces. And then they have the full-blown Xavier, and I think I don't know what powerful version of the Xavier's. They have 2 versions of it, but that has the 699-pin connector. So, Dave, is that the way you saw it too?
Kind of. Essentially, there's the Nano, the Jetson Nano. I think it's a division between the guys designing the stuff and the guys marketing it, because the names have been known to change rather suddenly. But there's an Xavier AVX or AGX something that's the high end one and uses the big plug, and there's now this Xavier NT module, which is like the Nano. They supposedly are plug compatible on a 260 pin SIP, inexpensive SIP. Sim type thing, and but the Xavier stuff is not absolutely critical, because I think it's extreme overkill for most of the radio things. I think even the Nano is very powerful, because you have your gigabit ether, you've got your 3.3 or 3.1 USB, you've got mini PCIe version 3 or 4. You've got you can do M.2 with it as well, and it's all on an inexpensive SIM memory card type connector. So that's the interesting part. And they've got various numbers of cores and whatnot, but that seems to be the strategy. They seem to recognize the value of a cheaper connector.
Yeah, but those are all called Jetsons. So if it's a Jetson Nano, that's the cheap one. If it's a Jetson NX Xavier, it's the middle one. And if it's the Jetson Xavier, then it's the high-end one, all using the 240-pin connector. Then they go to the Xavier AGX, which is the 699-pin connector. And then they have, I think, two Xavier, full-blown Xavier modules, if I remember. So it makes a total of five boards, which gives what KV0S was talking about on the TeamSpeak session. There's three levels of Jetson boards. There's the Nano, the NX, and then the Xavier, but they're all called Jetson Nano, Jetson NX, Xavier, Jetson Xavier. Now, I don't really approve of the way they reuse all these words for different boards, but this is the best I can decipher out of all their gobbledygook on the net, is that if it has a Jetson as its first name, it's got a 240-pin connector. If it's the AGX line, then it has the full-blown connector.
Excuse me, guys. Help me to understand, what is the reason why we're talking about these supercomputers on a chip? What are we going to use these for in the tangerine?
Nothing. This came up on the TeamSpeak session for HPSDR because we were talking about future data engines. And I was thinking of adding you probably have to lose one of the RFM2 connector, which is only going to be useful on the first data engines anyway, because it's going to be used just for debug. But the idea is we plug a slot and we plug this supercomputer in, and we can do a fast Fourier transform of the data directly coupled to the ADCs. And except for the Minerva project, I'm not really aware of anybody else that does that in any kind of budget you can afford. I think Matchstick has one for about $10,000, but that's the only other one I know of.
Yeah, because you're looking at what boards like this can do, you can use it's for AI, so you can do things like looking at a signal and automatically determining what mode it is. Is it FT8 or is it sideband or is it FM, and which of the many, you know, Olivia comes in like 14 different flavors, which Olivia mode was. I mean, you can do some incredible things if you're going to have this kind of processing power, but it seems to me that may be a bit down the road.
Yeah, you're talking cognitive radio, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing you can do. That's what these kind of things are designed for, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they are, and I think, Dave, you had a comment. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to mention that the low-end Nano is only not much more than the cost of two Odroids.
Is it still $100 or is it more than that now, Dave?
What? The production Nano module, at least the one I have, I paid $150. That's a little bit above list because it was, I don't know why, but I bought it from one of the major distributors. But the Nano is, but the prices move around on these things all over the place as time goes on. But the point is that there's a lot more processing power that could be plugged in, you know, should someone want it.
Well, and especially if they're going to standardize on a connector and make like three different levels of CUDA cores and AI chips available that will be plug compatible, now it starts to look really interesting to have a connector that'll accept one of those three boards.
That's kind of been what I've been thinking all along.
But it's not phase one, so don't get excited, Bill, because I'm not trying to creep the elegance in here, because you got to get phase one done first.
Yeah, well, you know that I enjoy working on deep learning systems. I was moving along on trying to figure out some of the 50 megahertz propagation using some of that kind of thing. But that's absolutely out of the scope of what we're trying to do for this project. But I certainly look forward to the future when we could do some. I mean, for example, there's a lot of signals that I see on the band, and you can actually look at them using a flex radio, which I have, and then said, what in the world kind of a signal is that? Man, I wish I knew what it was so that I could configure my one of my software packages to decode it. Well, I'd like to have something that we could teach it, so it would be able to tell me, oh, by the way, that's Olivia 15400 or whatever the funky new remote of the day happens to be.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. And actually, how we got on that subject on the HPSDR list was we started out by, I was describing the schematic that I'm working on for the data engine, and I said I'm making it modular. So the idea is that when it comes time to add a different FPGA, change the FPGA to a more powerful one, all of the peripheral area of the schematic can remain the same, exactly the same, and you just connect up, you rip out the old FPGA, which is on a couple of pages of the schematic, and all of the USB 3, gigabit Ethernet, RAM, whatever other peripherals we have, they all basically stay the same, and they just connect up to different pins of a different FPGA, or maybe a NVIDIA, one of these Xavier connectors, or maybe a combination of both. Definitely for the future, though, not for today, but just musing over making it easy to advance once we get the first data engine done and running and complete phase one. Where do we go from there? Well, maybe AI would be the next cool thing.
Yeah, that seems like a good down the road direction. Now, Dave, you said you bought one of these for $150 or whatever. What in the world are you using it for?
Nothing at the moment, frankly. Actually, I've got the NVIDIA AGX, the full-blown one as well. And I've been just too busy with new projects to do any of the things I thought I'd do. I have done some work with image radiology images in the past on these things, but not at nearly as much as I expected to.
Yeah, I mean, you can do real-time image processing with systems like this. I think you already mentioned that this is far beyond what you'd use for radio, but there may be other things coming down the road that this may come in handy for.
Yeah, one of the things that can be done is done for MIMO, multiple input, multiple output antennas, where what you do is to send a training tone on each transmit antenna of the two. And then the receiver looks for those particular symbols and is able to effectively make the signals from antenna one orthogonal to those from antenna two. And it has to do that by inverting a matrix, a complex matrix in real time, which is an order n cubed computation problem. So there are RF problems where I think the modules are applicable, but probably not PSWS phase one.
And okay. I wanted to mention that on the Open HPSDR project, we have a proof of concept of using a Jetson TK, which is an earlier generation of these boards, as a replacement for an FPGA in the Open HPSDR architecture.
Yeah, so in that, Phil does a direct Fourier transform of the RF coming in, and ships the bins off to the software that's running on the on an external computer, right, Dave?
Yes.
Actually, what he's doing there is he's got it plugged into a Jetson TK1, which is similar in power to the Jetson Nano, the cheapest of these boards, but the TK1 is not available anymore, but he's just plugged it into the PCIe socket on there, and that's what he's showing there, he and John Melton.
Right, and so what he has is he has an RF, an ADC, he's using an FPGA basically as a bridge from the ADC to PCI Express bus, which the Jetson TK has on board. So he gets a high bandwidth connection from the ADC to the memory on the Jetson board. And then he uses the CUDA cores on the Jetson board to massage that memory and do the FFT on the data. And so the thing that most of our other systems are missing is that high speed interface between the A to D and the whatever compute engine we have is. And that's kind of what the data engine solves, because we have tremendous bandwidth into the FPGA, and we also have very good bandwidth from the FPGA out to the single board computer. So we can do some massaging on the FPGA with the FPGA and some with the single board computer, and we don't throttle either the in or the out of the FPGA down to some low speed.
I have another question I wanted to bring up that's fairly different, but I don't want to cut this off if there are more comments.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, we have the data, high-speed data into the from the antenna through the ADC to the FPGA, and then if we were to put a one of these Jetson boards, a socket for it on the Rev 2 of the data engine, say, then we really would have a high-speed connection right into the CUDA cores on that board. So we basically would be kind of replicating what Phil has done with the Minerva project, don't you think, Dave?
I agree.
So we're kind of taking existing hardware and we're going to tweak it a little bit, come out with a data engine too, and we'll have the capability to further on Phil's project, which is kind of stopped because Phil's off doing other things. But, you know, that's a ways down the road. And I mean, we may opt to not go that way or go that way, depending on what people want to do with as the next steps.
Well, the one thing I wanted to comment about is we're designing stuff as though we're a science unit and we have control over all these boards. I'm wondering what the motivation is to an individual to buy an Odroid and a data engine and set it up and put it on the network and then just let somebody else come and pull data off of it. We haven't provided the citizen scientist any kind of motivational impotence to be a participant in the project. And we're even setting up the command and control to minimize the role of the citizen scientist in that setting. And I'm wondering, that to me doesn't seem to encourage them to participate.
So you're talking about not the ham guys, but the scientist guys?
No, well, you know, it's ham sci. So if you were the owner of a single board computer with a data engine and the peripherals that we're setting, what's in it? What are the what does that individual get out of it? So when you look at the weather analogy, you get a whole weather station that you could run yourself. And what we're doing here, at least what we're talking about, most of the development is aimed at getting the data to Bill's server and less about, well, what does the individual who sits with that one board in radio get to see and learn about what's going on in the ionosphere?
Well, Dave, I have an answer for that. Part of the what we're going to implement here, even in phase one, is we're going to give the individual user a local propagation analyzer. Assuming that Scotty is able to give me enough data feeds, and I think the data engine that's been being designed here is capable of doing this, we're going to collect propagation data on, at the very least, on FT8 and possibly Whisper as well, so that the user will be able to see what kind of traffic has been heard at my station recently. You know how you can see all that in PSK Reporter? I don't necessarily want to take over the role of PSK Reporter, because we are planning on uploading all of the noticed spots to PSK Reporter. But a lot of that kind of stuff is going to be available locally. And also an additional feature of being able to let the user know, if the user wants to set it up this way, a configuration will be possible, so that if you would like, if you as a user would like to listen and be notified of a particular station coming on the air, a particular grid being heard, and then you'll get a text message. You get an email, and if you configure it such, it'll go to one of these services that will forward email to text. And I have actually used this for watching to see when friends of mine will come on D-Star using software that I've written. I'll get a text message that tells me, okay, OKK5H in Huntsville was just heard on D-Star repeater so-and-so. And then I can hop on and talk to that person. So if you want to watch for, you want to watch the DX clusters, you want to watch FT, you know, Whisper, you want to watch WSJTX traffic and then get notified, or even you keep a log of all that stuff and visualize it on a map and then take a look at it, how it changes day to day and week to week. A lot of that we're planning on making available even in phase one. At least that's what I have in mind, unless somebody tells me not to do it. We are planning to put that in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that's very important, Bill.
Yeah, and I was saying that that kind of stuff is important if we want people to go out and buy these units and install them, both for the geographic diversity, but also just to have a larger number of people participating. Obviously, if Nathan's university decides to buy 100 of them, those 100 stations wouldn't really need to be set up with that all for the other scientists, but they might.
I just think it's really good idea to not lose sight of the guy who's buying one of these out of pocket.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that, and I very much want this amateur, something that really gives something to the amateur radio operator.
Well, I know that the Whisper guys have been clamoring for an all-band Whisper box. I don't know if they succeed in getting it. I think maybe the Kiwi SDR comes closest to doing that.
I think that is something that they're coming close to. I don't fully know. But I think if we can find something that has a really good intersection of what is of interest to the hams and what is of interest to the scientists, I think we have a winner there. And, I've already done a number of studies, a few studies where I just take RBN and WhisperNet data. And so if we can create a device that just, does more reception of that sort of data and makes it available both to hams and to the science community, I think that would be really good.
Yeah, and there's your incentive that you were talking about, Dave.
Yeah, I'm a scientist. That was my work job. I'm also a ham, and I also am interested in developing the best SDR radios that can be built. And so I have my own motivations, but thinking about normal hams, when I try to explain some of these things to them, they often, after a point, tune out because there's too much math and too much, it's too complicated.
Or it costs the same as a KX3, so why should I buy yours?
Yes.
I tell them to go buy a KX3 when they ask me that question.
I would too.
Because I don't want to sell them something you're not going to like.
That's right.
Scotty,
there's a lot of great rigs out there. Go ahead.
Yeah, Scotty, you were looking for some power consumption estimates.
Yeah, do you have an idea of what kind of power you're going to need on the I think you're going to need 3.3 and 1.8. Those are just the only two, right?
Negative. I've got the list here. I'll put it in the meeting minutes. I need 10 milliamps at plus 12 volts. I need a minimum of 160 milliamps at plus 5 and a maximum of 230 milliamps at plus 5. That's all. That swing is from no relays to all relays selected. I need 100 milliamps from plus 3.3 and 65 milliamps from plus 1.8.
Okay, because on the 12 volts, does it have to be 12.0 or can it be more of a wide range?
Oh, it can be more of a wide range. There's a current regulator on it that takes it and turns it into a 10 milliamp current source. that feeds a Zener diode, so it can have quite a few volts of range.
So if it was say 11 to 15, would that be okay?
No problem at all.
Okay, because I've been trying to figure out how I want to do the power supply, and I really wanted to be able to make something that is going to be able to tolerate up to 24 volts input. So I'm thinking it's going to be multiple stages. So we're going to do a wide range input down to 12 volts. But of course, if your input is down to 12, then you're not really going to get 12. You're going to get more like 11, you know, because you're going to have about a volt of overhead. And so really the secondary regulator output is going to be not really a regulator output. It's going to be 11 to 12, somewhere in that range, not more than 12, but a volt less than whatever the input voltage is. So if you're running on a 13.8, you'll have no problem. But if you plug it into a cigarette lighter and you run it down to 12.2 or 12.0, you might only get 11. But what I'm planning on using the 12 volts for is, other than your reference, your current source there, is to operate the PA. So what's going to happen is you're just going to get a little bit less power out of the PA. And if we use a PA similar to what the Hermes board used, we have to limit the voltage to 12 volts for the safety of the parts. So we have to do that. So, and then I need plus 5, plus 3.3, plus 1.8, plus 1.2, and plus 1.5 for the DRAM. So I've got lots of regulators to implement.
Okay. Yeah, the 12 volt, I haven't looked at the spec on the current regulator, but I think probably it might even go down to 10 volts. So that can have a very loose tolerance. The 5 volts doesn't need to be super tightly regulated. You know, 4.5 to 5.5 is probably fine. The 3.3 and the 1.8 need to be pretty tight, not ultra tight, but reasonably tight.
So do you have the power, the current requirements again?
Yeah, 12 volts is 10 milliamps. 5 volts is a minimum of 160 and a maximum of 230 milliamps. 160 milliamps when there's no relay selected. 230 milliamps when all six of them are turned on. 3.3 volts needs 100 milliamps max, and 1.8 volts needs 65 milliamps max.
And nothing below 1.8, right?
Right. I'll have this in the meeting notes, so if you didn't catch it, it'll be in the notes that come out right afterwards.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's sufficient for what I need to. It's less than I thought it would be, so that's good, because the 65 milliamps at 1.8, that's for the two ADCs, right? That's not very much current.
That is for the LVDS drivers on the ADC, and then there's 100 milliamps for the analog circuitry. But that 100 milliamps for the analog circuitry is supplied by a low noise regulator off of the 3.3 volt line.
Okay, but still, even if you add 100 milliamps at 3 volts and 65 milliamps at 1.8, that's not much power.
No, it's not much power. The A to D driver takes 160 milliamps, and that comes off of the 5-volt line. That's where the minimum comes from. So the total power consumption is, you know, typically going to be on the order of about 1.5 watts for all the supplies put together, maybe 2 watts.
Okay, so the core of the ADC, the analog part or the conversion part, is that, you said that's run off of 3.3 volts with an internal LDO or something?
Okay. The ADC has two supplies. It has a digital supply on 1.8 volts, and in the LVDS mode, that's 65 milliamps. And then it has an analog supply on 1.8 volts, and that consumes 100 milliamps. I source the 1.8 volt analog off of a regulator that's on the RF module circuit board. It's not inside the chip. It's a separate regulator, and it's a low noise, low dropout regulator. So that 100 milliamps ends up coming from the 3.3 volt supply.
Okay, got it. I understand now. So, very good. That's good. But even so, 100 mils at 1.8 volts is only about a fifth of a watt. And then 65 mils for the LVDS, for the VDDIO, I guess is what you'd call it, is still, so it's the ADC's really under half a watt then.
Yeah, right now the spec on it is 300 milliwatts.
Okay, I guess I'm used to these 2208 type parts that draw 1.5 watts.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons that I kind of tried to go this way, was to get dual channels, get reasonable performance, and not have to have a huge number of power supplies.
Yeah, okay, sounds good, because really the last two pieces I'm working on are the power supply and the clocking topology. And I think I sent out the clocking topology. There's a document up on the website that has a diagram of that. So we're going to have to revisit that in the next week or so.
Yeah, we will. There's the whole thing needs to be gone over now that reality has set in and we have a real connector and real pins and real signals. We have to probably go back and revisit our documents.
Yep. And make sure they agree with the schematics.
Yep. Okay. Didn't mean to interrupt the rest of the conversation. I knew you asked for that at the beginning and just wanted to make sure we got it before time ran out.
Well, thanks. Thanks. Yeah. Cause I need that for my calculations here.
I also want to let people listening know that Scotty, in all his infinite spare time, has written an article for QEX on hands-on SDR, and it will be in the January-February issue of QEX.
That's really great, Scotty.
Say again, Nathaniel?
That's really great, Scotty. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
So you guys haven't gotten your issues yet?
Mine are always slow.
Yeah, mine normally come around the 10th of the month, so 10th of January would be estimated.
Well, if you get QST, go look on page 21, and there is a teaser for QEX, and it says that my new hands-on SRD column is going to be revived.
Yeah, I saw that. I haven't seen an article on step recovery diodes in a long time.
This is a software radio defined. So, okay, so Tom, we have to put a step recovery diode into one of the boards. But let me ask you
first.
I'm
sure we'll find something to use it for. I'm sure we'll find something to use it for.
So what is a step recovery diode? So I can be educated.
I'll have to answer that one next week. I don't remember.
It sounds cool, though. Anyway, so Nathaniel, any more word on whether you're going to make it to about Hamcation in February?
I think it's probably going to happen. I just need to book my tickets and get all that worked out.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I saw in QEX today that there is a SARA conference in Socorro, New Mexico, the weekend after Hamcation.
Well, that's pretty cool.
So I was thinking of going there because on Sunday they're going to have a tour of the VLA.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, I think you should do that.
Yeah, so it's a good drive from here, but if we have the VLA tour on Sunday, then that's just part of the way home for me. I just continue on driving. So we'll see if I'm going to be, I have to think about it a little bit because I don't like putting conferences back to back on adjacent weekends. It kind of burns you out.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I know it would be way too much for me, but if you could go, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, you might be able to market the SDR, and they're looking for papers, so yeah, I might give them a talk on the PSWS and the Tangerine.
Yeah, I think that would be great.
Yeah, squeeze in among all these talks and articles, I got to find time to actually do the design.
Well, I know, I know the Radio Jove people are very interested in the Tangerine SDR, so yeah, there probably are other people in Sarah who would be as well.
Yes, in fact, I think we have one guy on the mailing list who is a Radio Jove guy.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm going to try and bring the main Radio Jove scientist to the HamSci workshop.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I was talking with him at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and he has a really nice result looking at some HF, a specific HF propagation signature that he thinks is a result of lightning.
Okay, good. Well, from where I stand now, there's no way I'm going to have hardware at Hamcation, but I'm going to really try to have hardware by HamSci.
That sounds great.
Because HamSci would really be important to have at least a built board for.
Yeah, we'd really like to see that there. That would be really good.
Especially after all the work that everyone here has put in and other people too over what it's coming up on. It was a year in September, so by HamSci time, it'll be about 18 months.
Yeah, it's amazing how time flies there.
Yeah, I thought we'd be further along, but, you know, life gets in the way, and discussions of what we're actually going to build gets in the way, too.
I know, and I know I still have a few more details to get worked out with the HamSci workshop, but I think they're almost all put together. As you've seen the website, I know you've booked your flight and we're working on the hotel, but people are out until after the New Year's on vacation. So I've got a few outstanding things there. And then once New Year rolls around, I'll get back on that and try and get all those the rest of the details wrapped up and get the rest of the program put together.
Okay, or I might be borrowing a tent living in the nearby park there.
Oh, no, there's you're definitely going to have a room. Don't worry.
Well, you know, it could be like Occupy Scranton.
Yeah, no, really, you're not going to have to worry about that.
I'd much rather worry about it in June than in March.
Oh, that would be terrible. It'd be so cold. We're just wet.
Nathaniel, on a different subject, do you know if the NGIT guys have got the mirror of the Hamside database up and running? Because I'm looking at a potential minor re-architecting of the way the database is set up, and I'd like to find out if that's going to pose a headache for them. Because the PSK database is so huge and unwieldy, I'm thinking about creating a series of tables where each table may be like 1 year's worth instead of having everything all in one gigantic table. So it would actually be practical to do and search, you know. But anyway, I'd like to find out if they have the mirror up and running, because I've also been collecting logs, and now we have gigabytes worth of logs that need to be purged.
Unfortunately, I don't think they do. I have been trying to get that going. But I think at this point, I'm going to go back to NGIT and bring that hardware and try and get it set up in Scranton instead. So I would say just go ahead and do what you need to do, Bill.
Okay, because, you know, it's always possible to rebuild it if we need to. I just don't want to have hundreds of gigabytes of space being taken up that's not going to any purpose.
Yeah, no, go ahead, do what you need to do, and then we'll try and rebuild over in Scranton.
And by the way, all the log data will still remain out on the box site. We don't have any space penalty there. So at the point where you, if you want to rebuild you using the logs, it'll be possible to do that.
Okay, that sounds good. So I think once I get the hardware brought back over to Scranton, I think I'm going to try and talk. I've actually started talking with some of the research IT people that they have over here about working with them to do this sort of synchronization rather than having a student work on it. But I think it's probably not going to happen as quickly as I'd like it to.
Understood. Well, just keep me apprised of what you find out on that.
I will definitely let you know.
Well, to appease Tom, we're getting a little past our time.
Thank you, Dave.
So anyone have anything else, or are we good for to wrap up 2019 and the decade?
Scotty, I need to clarify something about those pictures, but we don't need to hold everybody for that.
Okay, well, it's just a simple comment. It was the dual gigabit Ethernet port MAX 10 board that I was looking for, the chip number. And I don't know what that board was you put the picture up of, but it was something small.
It was a Terasic USB blaster. You were asking me the letters on the board, and so I thought that's what you were after.
Oh, no, sorry, I misunderstood. I'm after the marking on the FPGA, and it will be a 10M50, 484, and then it'll. I want to know if it ends in a -6 or a -6ES. There's not, no, sorry, no dashes, but it ends in 6ES. Or not, because the one I have says ES, which means engineering sample. And I didn't realize that they were producing boards with samples on them.
Okay, well, I have a picture of that, and then I can read it myself, and I'll send you both.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate it.